This is Criminal Behaviorology, a combination of criminology and behavior analysis to assist the criminal and civil justice systems to improve our society in general. A podcast like no other. Here is your host, Timothy Joseph.
Hello, and this is your host, Timothy Joseph, and this is Criminal Behaviorology. You know, I really want to, as I've done before, thank the listeners of the podcast who have grown in a couple of recent podcasts and even things that I didn't think you would be interested in. You are interested in, and I've got a lot of good feedback. We've got over 1,000 downloads on one particular podcast that was done months ago, so I really appreciate your interest. I know that there are other podcasts out there, like some 650,000 or more. Apparently, it's a more popular method of gaining information than I initially realized. But that's okay. It's part of a source of all success, perhaps, is competition. So I really want to thank you for choosing this podcast to listen to. I'm going to cover an interview I did recently, and it has to do with the exploitation of crime itself. I came across the article, Crime Sploitation, by Paul Kaplan and Daniel LeChance, and that's in had an online publication in April of 2017. It says, Crimesploitation is a kind of reality television program that depicts non-actors committing, detecting, prosecuting, and punishing criminal behavior in programs like Cops, To Catch a Predator, and Intervention. A real-life documentary frame creates a sense of verisimilitude that intensifies the show's emotionally stimulating qualities and sets it apart from fictional crime stories. Crimesploitation programs create folk knowledge about the causes and consequences of criminal behavior and the purposes and effects of criminal punishment. That folk knowledge, in turn, reflects and reinforces two ideologies that legitimize the ratcheting up of harsh punishment in the late 20th century United States. So, Professor Paul Kaplan was kind enough to find the time to be interviewed here on the podcast, and we talked about the dangers of this kind of portrayal, the popularity of these shows, and the possible hidden agenda in the development of such entertainment that formed the basis of crimesploitation. And so among the things that we covered was how you can distinguish crimesploitation from other kinds of educational programming on crime, corrections, and addiction. And that includes programs like this podcast. Who are the likely audiences of a crimesploitation program? What is the addiction industrial complex? Does crimesploitation justify police misconduct or vigilante justice? And how a program like To Catch a Predator, I've watched that show, how that show came to an abrupt end, and how such voyeuristic broadcasts may promote an escape from social responsibilities here in this modern world. And we cover some other areas. So please keep listening. Stay tuned. I think it's one of our best interviews. And if you like what you heard, go ahead and go on the podcast, any of the podcast sites, and go ahead and give a review. And you can also email me at criminalbehaviorology@gmail.com. criminalbehaviorology@gmail.com to inquire about any episode or just to give us your general comments. Thanks again for listening, and let's go ahead and listen now to the interview with Paul Kaplan. Hello, Dr. Kaplan?
Yes. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Is the weather nice out there in California?
Yeah, it's nice. It's a sunshine tax in San Diego, so when we get hired at a place like San Diego State University, they sell us on the sunshine in months like November, but pay us less.
Okay.
So it's kind of quality of life.
Okay. Yeah, it is certainly beautiful out there, so I don't know if it's worth the charge or not, but it's very scenic. So perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about your career and your life, and you've had some different interests here. You can tell us about what you've been working on and what led you to the interest you have now.
Certainly, yeah. So my interest in criminology, I'm a professor of criminology, or actually technically of criminal justice at San Diego State.
Uh-huh.
My prior life was working on capital cases, death penalty cases for the defense,
uh-huh,
in a role called mitigation investigator.
Okay.
So I worked for about 6 years as a mitigation investigator on behalf of people facing the death penalty or execution in California. I did that work for several years, which led me to pursue graduate school and a PhD in criminology from the University of California, Irvine. And I finished that in 2007, and I've been at San Diego State since then. And over the years, I've published most of my research for the first part of my career was on the death penalty. And I have a book called Murder Stories, which is about capital punishment, and a number of publications in that area. And in the last 5 years or so, I've sort of moved into what we call cultural criminology.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I've teamed up with Dr. Daniel LeChance, who is a professor at Emory University. And he and I have been collaborating on this concept called crime exploitation for a little while. And do a couple of publications and a book. We're trying to finish up a book, which we just signed a contract with Stanford University Press, so we're really excited about that. And so there'll be a book called Crime Exploitation coming out in probably about a year from now.
Mm-hmm. On the death penalty, I get asked about it once in a while. Do you see it, this might be an old question, but is it seen as a deterrent in the modern literature, or has that even become a part of the discussion anymore?
Good question, and a good way to frame the question. It's an old question that isn't really resolved. If you look at the empirical evaluations of the purported deterrent effect of the death penalty, there's an article that came out about 5 years ago that was in a journal called the Criminology and Public Policy, which is a prominent journal, and it was an evaluation of the empirical research on deterrence and the death penalty. And the findings of that review were that it is not possible to make a claim, really, about the deterrent effect using sophisticated statistical techniques. The evidence doesn't tell us if there's any appreciable deterrent effect. So I guess the less academic way to put that is that you can't make a claim that it deters,
mm-hmm,
based on the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
It, of course, it might deter a person.
Yeah, right.
You know, you or I, perhaps. I mean, I don't think that's what's stopping me from killing anybody, but it might deter somebody. But as a public policy, as a law, the evidence doesn't support it as a deterrent effect.
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah, I think most people, when they're thinking of deterrent, the other criminals, would-be criminals, are going to hear about this death penalty, and then they're going to refrain or be less likely to be criminals in the future because of it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's commonsensical, but in my experience working on a number of capital cases over the years, people who undertake capital murder are not weighing pros and cons and carefully,
mm-hmm,
thinking about what they're doing. So it could deter a very, I don't know, a career criminal bank robber who doesn't want to kill somebody during that action, but it's not going to deter highly intoxicated, infuriated husband finding his wife in an affair or something, like a much more typical kind of homicide in America.
Mm-hmm.
So the theory that a punishment of any kind, not just the death penalty, but any punishment sanction that we have on the books in America is going to have a strong deterrent effect has to assume that the people that are thinking about doing crime are thinking about it carefully. And
mm-hmm.
most people aren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and over here in the part of the purpose of my podcast is behavior analysis, and if people are saying that something has an effect, I want to see the evidence for that, and not just a gut feeling or a speculation about it. So very, very good information. Could you tell us what is crime exploitation?
Certainly, yeah. Crime exploitation it's a kind of a catchy term that Chance and I came up with after we became aware of we started to think about reality TV shows about crime. So there's this genre of reality television, which has been around since the 80s. I mean, there have been documentary films about it, you know, crime since mm-hmm. since film, you know, it was invented. But the reality TV program featuring crime and punishment really started in the 1980s with a TV show called Cops.
Right.
And that show still runs. It's still around. It's kind of the grandfather of the idea of crime exploitation. But what we mean when we say crime exploitation is a television program that depicts what it claims to be true crime stories. So we're not talking about fiction. We're not talking about detective procedural TV shows that are scripted. We're talking about reality TV.
Mm-hmm.
And we call it crime exploitation because these programs echo exploitation media, or I should say exploitation films, that started in the 30s and through the 40s into the 50s. There was a period in American film prior to the 60s where we had this thing called the exploitation film.
Right.
And there's a great book, and of course I don't have it right in front of me, and I've now forgotten the author's name, but I could refer it to you if you wanted to include it later. But
mm-hmm.
There's a book that studies this history of film and this period in American filmmaking where the films were depicting some allegedly true kind of experience, such as drug use or a documentary about pregnancy or something like that, but the real motivation was to depict something illicit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way for people to experience some kind of illicit culture,
mm-hmm.
Like drug use or sexuality or something, without it being explicitly that. So
mm-hmm.
whereas in 1950, pornography was illegal, mostly in the U.S., there were sort of these fake educational films about venereal disease or pregnancy or something,
mm-hmm.
which enabled people to experience a cultural scene that was supposedly off limits for them under the guise of a kind of an educational
mm-hmm.
veneer.
Mm-hmm.
And our argument about crime exploitation, what we're doing is we're sort of referencing that old story and saying that these shows that have been happening for 30 or 40 years, whatever it is, and there's tons of them that are currently very popular on TV now,
mm-hmm.
are doing something similar where they're promising a view of something illicit that is not pornographic or a snuff film where you're showing somebody being killed. They're hinting at those kinds of things without actually showing it, and it's a kind of a crime tourism experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the essence of the idea, because there's been plenty of scholarship on voyeuristic TV and stuff like that and reality TV, and I think that the one part of the story that we're trying to explore a little bit more than much of this other scholarship has is the seductive aspects of these shows, in the sense that whereas it seems obvious, so you might watch a TV show like Cops or Gangland or whatever and identify with the police and you want to catch the bad guys and punish them, we're arguing in crime exploitation that some viewers, many viewers perhaps, actually identify with the deviance that's occurring on these shows and find it seductive. Even if that's not at the forefront of their consciousness, they may be nevertheless vicariously identifying with criminals or drug users or experiencing it as a thrill that isn't just a sort of a punitive stance on crime and punishment.
I've certainly come across things like that on television, and there's a lot on the internet now of these kinds of shows.
Yeah.
I'm curious where the limits of where crime exploitation might be, because, I mean, if with a historical documentary about a particular crime, do you think that, say, on A&E or something like that, would that qualify as crime exploitation? Or maybe a podcast?
Well, that's a good question. Go ahead.
A podcast, even like this one, maybe. You know, I mean, where would we say this is an educational program if it is kind of under the guise of that type of genre, when in reality the crime exploitations are more to excite and affect people emotionally?
Yeah, great question. Yes, I think that that's hard to answer a little bit, but my belief is that there's a kind of a continuum, and that you could one of the things we're trying to do in our book is to be more precise about understanding that continuum. But, you know, a documentary is, first of all, that there's in film, there are rules and expectations about what a documentary should or should not be. And because A&E or the History Channel or many of these other cable channels call something a documentary, doesn't necessarily mean it corresponds to what a documentary filmmaker or, you know, coming out of film school might say is, in fact, a documentary. I think one of the features of crime exploitation is the extent to, or a way to understand it as either more or less exploitive, is the extent to which there is some form of profit taking place. And I don't necessarily mean just capital profit, like money.
Uh-huh.
It could even be cultural capital. If somebody's benefiting from it, you know, the more that somebody's benefiting from the construction and dissemination of the media, the more it's exploitive, probably. Although that's not a hard and fast rule.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great film that would count as a documentary that LaChance and I reference in our most recent paper, which talks about a show called Making a Murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of take down Making a Murderer a little bit in that paper as a remaining somewhat exploited despite maintaining a kind of highbrow aesthetic, I guess I would say. But we finished that paper by referencing a documentary called The Prison in 12 Landscapes by a filmmaker called Brett Story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fantastic, but it's also not exploitive. It's about prisons without ever showing any images of prisons or the inside of prisons or prisoners or anything. It's about spaces that interact with prisons or aspects of the large institutional relations that connect to prisons in a way that enables the viewer to develop an understanding of the influence of prisons in American society without looking at bars and concrete walls and guys with face tattoos and muscles and stuff like that, which are, that's all you see in a documentary you might find on A&E or Nat Geo or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's an excellent question. I think the podcast one's going to be, we're going to have to figure that one out, because I think Serial, for example, which got a lot of notoriety a few years ago, is an interesting one. I don't think I want to try to make a claim yet about whether that's exploitive or not. It certainly benefited the podcasters hugely, because it enabled them to launch, the careers exploded. But at the same time, I believe that their interest in it wasn't really that. You know, I believe that they were attempting to illuminate this possible wrongful conviction. So it's a good question. You know, I don't know exactly. I think I hate to do this because it's so frustrating. might say something like, I know it when I see it.
Uh-huh.
I definitely can tell you if I'm looking at, you know, gangland or Drugs Incorporated or any of these, mm-hmm. you know, sort of primetime cable shows, they're pretty bad
mm-hmm.
and exploitive and not helping people understand criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Making a Murderer, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Although yeah. it's still, at the end of the day, I think, it might be a retributive impulse by focusing on the downfall of the prosecutor in a way that is a little bit counter to the progressive aesthetic of that show. I don't have a great, like, one-liner answer for that, unfortunately.
Right. I mean, it could be said that certain shows clearly have an educational goal to them, that they are trying to say something that we, most of the public, probably should know and didn't need to know, like maybe a program about gun control or something like that, while others are really just trying to exploit our emotions.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice, tidy way to put it. And I think the tricky, once it starts to get into the academic weeds, is when the ones that really do seem rather clearly educational and helpful sometimes fall into narrative traps that aren't obvious, and that's what we were kind of seeing in Making a Murderer. Mm-hmm. But you're probably right that there are many excellent documentaries about crime and punishment, or, you know, media forms, podcasts, etc., about crime and punishment that are doing a great job of not being exploitive. And because, of course, if you the $64,000 question would be, you know, is any discussion of crime and punishment exploitive? And that would be pretty limiting to say that, and I don't think we're going to try to make that claim.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think there's an interesting question about that around the ethics of ever disseminating human suffering in any kind of, no matter what. I mean, there's a debate in this field we call cultural criminology about the ethics of depicting human suffering ever, even if it's for a completely progressive, good, reformative, educational reason. And, you know, it isn't something that's been resolved among us talking about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're probably right that, you know, for the most part, you could do something that is educational and helpful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends what the motivation is. If the motivation is to, for example, understand guns and the role of guns in America, you know, it is possible to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what, there's a pretty good book on guns in America called Guns Across America,
mm-hmm.
and it's not that. But the cover, you know, has, you know, these kind of interesting, attractive graphic images of weapons on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so where does that fall in? It's a little tricky.
And I don't want to spend just too much time on defining it, but it brings up the question, the modern news, either cable or local news stories, do they engage in crime exploitation?
They are crime exploitation,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I don't think that the 5 o'clock news in most cities in America are able to, I think that they're constrained, they don't even know it, but they're constrained structurally from talking about it in a way that's really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't really blame the TV news people so much for that, because of all of the constraints that limit them. They have a few seconds or a minute or something to talk about it. But yeah, absolutely. You know, there's the old line, if it bleeds, it leads.
And yeah.
There's a certain laziness to media, in media. This, I don't mean to be hypercritical, but, you know, to use stock footage of the blue and red lights of a cop car, and then, like, the yellow tape, and there's blood on the ground and things like that. And, you know, you never even know if that's actually the crime scene that they're talking about. It could be stock footage or something like that. So I think that it's crime exploitation, but it's, I think, less problematic than the primetime TV shows. You know, for example, which is something we're writing about in our book. It was a very, very popular show about addiction and recovery and this thing they call an intervention when there's a person called an interventionist who works with the family of somebody abusing substances, and they try to get this what they call in the program an addict to go into rehab.
Right.
And if you watch the show, so I've watched a whole bunch of episodes of Intervention, and my analysis of it is that it's not about recovery at all. It's about watching people become intoxicated. If you watch it, it's an hour-long show, or it's about a 45-minute show without commercials, and the vast majority of those minutes are devoted to scenes of the addict intoxicating herself. Whatever they're doing, drinking alcohol, injecting heroin, methamphetamine, whatever. So the point I'm making here is simply that the long form, prime time version of crime exploitation is more insidious, I think, than the short newscast, because the short newscasts are short and also not really developing a grand narrative, you know, whereas these shows are doing things like that.
Certain shows are putting a lot of effort into the exploitive element of crime.
And I think that the problem for people interested in understanding crime and punishment in America is that the narrative, right, the story that develops in a show like Intervention or a show like Gangland or a show like Lock Up, Dog the Bounty Hunter,
right?
They can and sometimes have a sense of, I don't know, uplifting love and hope. And there's a sense in some of these programs of somebody pulling themselves up by their bootstraps and restoring themselves and restoring their family or something like that. But it's all packaged inside of a bigger story about, on Intervention, for example, what is addiction and intoxication and recovery, what do those things mean? And a show like that is part of a big national story around what those things mean and the significance of them. And at the moment in America, there's this thing that people have been calling the opiate crisis, but a parallel to that has been the development of something which you could call the addiction industrial complex. I wish I had thought that phrase up. It's actually not mine, but it's a politician in New Jersey who I've forgotten the name of who coined that phrase. But there's a whole world of a billion-dollar industry of recovery that requires its raw materials in that industry are people, human beings suffering from various maladaptive behaviors that, you know, intoxicants and other kinds of harmful behaviors that this entire huge industry needs. So it's a complicated story that is not anywhere close to engage with on a show like Intervention.
There's several things I've looked up. Stop the treatment industrial complex. I don't see the name of it, but I had not heard of that before, actually. So that's very interesting. Who do you think is the target audience of a crime exploitation type show?
That's an interesting question. I wish I had a better answer, because I would like to talk to some of the producers and see what they say, and that's something what LaChance and I have been wanting to do, and we haven't been able to do it yet. And I don't know that much about TV marketing. But I think that if you look at, what I would say about that is that there are two kinds of audiences that these shows are targeting. One of them is the middle class person who wants to learn and observe illicit behavior safely. In other words, I'm curious about prison, so I'll watch Lock Up. Oh, what's it like? Something like that. And it could be anybody, any person vaguely interested in prison. But I think there's a kind of a covert audience, which are people with intimate knowledge about these worlds. So I was just actually talking the other day with one of my students who is a formerly incarcerated person, and she's now a master's student here at San Diego State. She was in prison for, I think, 6 years for multiple bank robberies.
Okay.
And is now kind of this reformed person and getting her master's degree. And she is saying that when she was locked up, that she and her friends in there would in the rec room where they had a television, they would watch a lot of these kinds of crime exploitation shows.
Mm-hmm.
And understand it from an insider's stance, right? So they're able to kind of decipher it and think about it in a totally different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's plenty of people around watching. You know, you might say that, just again, returning to the example of intervention, you might say that a target audience is a mom who wants to understand how a person can recover and gain hope and turn mm-hmm. their lives around. But it also might be interesting for a person who has knowledge of drug use and wants to know more about it, or wants to fetishizes watching somebody smoke methamphetamine or inject heroin or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they wouldn't tell you that, I don't think. I'd be curious to see if the producers of a show like Intervention would say, yeah, we want heroin addicts to watch
mm-hmm.
Intervention while they're shooting up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, but I think they are targeting that audience. It's just that I doubt that they would be comfortable saying it unless mm-hmm. they were totally off the record.
Well, from watching some of these kinds of shows that come on, I definitely get the impression that women are a target audience.
You get the impression of what?
That women are the adult women.
Oh, well, now why do you say that?
Well, a lot of it is based on, it's like fear of, it's either a woman like living in terror of they really emphasize the music at the point, and they go into a lot about her life and what was going on, some of the struggles she went through, and then it's fear for women and children that seem really emphasized in a lot of these
right.
shows. So and sometimes I look and see the commercials that are on there with it, and this must be the target audience. Not dated, very speculative on my part, but I do suspect that.
It's an interesting point. Yeah, I hadn't thought much about that. I think you could really go down an interesting rabbit hole on mm-hmm. gender with this, because in addition to, there's kind of a flip side to that coin, right? Because on the one hand, a lot of these shows are tapping into fear that I have mostly thought about as kind of middle-class fear, but it may very well be very gendered fear.
Mm-hmm.
But you can think about the gender dynamics in interesting other ways. Like, for example, Lock Up, the TV show Lock Up, has lots and lots of half-naked guys lifting weights
uh-huh.
and, you know, muscular, scary-looking dudes. And there's many ways that could be thought about in through a lens of gender.
Uh-huh.
One, it could be fear. Two, it could be kind of softcore, tough guy porn.
Uh-huh.
Another one is that men could be watching it and wondering how they picked her up. How would I handle myself in there? Could uh-huh. I, you know, would I be able to fight with these guys? Whatever. There's lots of different ways that it could be understood.
Uh-huh.
But I think you're right that there's a gender angle that we probably haven't developed nearly enough yet
uh-huh.
in the work. But yeah. Just an analysis of the commercials would be interesting.
Yeah.
We haven't done that.
Yeah. You have written that there's two ideologies in crime exploitation, of neoliberalism and law and order punitivism, which I think we've talked about a little bit. If neoliberalism is a part of a movement to, say, delegitimize the role of government, is that what can you say about that idea?
I think that the way we see, so if you think of neoliberalism as the withdrawal of the state, or the advocating for a small state, and for the transformation of the labor market to a service and sort of finance-based labor market, privatization, the irony of neoliberalism, because what we would call law and order punitivism is a sort of a weird consequence of neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's because that's the one part of the government that grows under neoliberalism. So everything's supposed to be except the cops and then the military. And the military is a different, you know, separate issue that I don't want to try to get into, but right. I think in terms of the way that the state in its, with the law enforcement and, you know, prosecution, courts, cops, that whole side of the state grows under neoliberalism is partly because it isn't thought of as the state exactly. Of course it is the state, but it isn't, people are able to see it less as a state apparatus, even though it's the most obvious state apparatus. It's literally the state of California versus, you know, John Doe. But I think that lots and lots of people wandering around in society don't stuff in their first blush at thinking about the state, they don't think about the cops and the courts and prosecutors and judges and prisons as the state. And, there's some people who have written about this a little bit. Frank Zimring, a famous criminologist some years ago, made a claim in a book about the death penalty that people don't think of the death penalty as state violence because they perceive it as an action on behalf of crime victims, kind of a vigilantist action. So if you think of retribution, you know, get the bad guy and hurt him. Neoliberalism has somehow enabled itself to understand that as an important function of the state that is exempted from the limitations on the state. So if the state is just getting the bad guys and hurting them, it's okay. I think that's the way that I would try to summarize our understanding of how neoliberalism can accommodate the large state apparatuses of the police and courts and prisons and things like that.
So, yeah, at one point the article said that these shows undermine a presumption of innocence and bypass legal procedures justified by it. Do you think crime exploitation programs partially justify maybe police misconduct or aggressive police tactics or even vigilante justice?
I think that in their role as a cultural narrative, they absolutely do. I think that it becomes a little more tricky when the cops, or, you know, to be a little bit more formal, when state apparatuses get involved or entangled with crime exploitation, it gets a little trickier. So whereas the story of a show like Lock Up or Gangland or any of those certainly de-emphasizes due process and any of the elements of due process, including presumption of innocence. But there have been interesting cases where government apparatuses have resisted crime exploitation. And I think, you know, there have been plenty of like police departments that have decided not to participate in TV shows like Cops. And the most notorious example that LaChance and I have referenced, is in a previous paper, which we wrote about the show To Catch a Predator, which was another popular one that was around for a long time. And in that case, that TV show, without revisiting it completely, the essence of it was that the show itself created a sting operation in which it attempted to lure alleged sexual predators to a house, after which they would be arrested by actual law enforcement officers. And so it's very popular and successful, and we deconstruct that show in the paper. I could talk about that another time, but eventually that show, in one of their sting operations, they figured out that the alleged predator that they were interacting with, that their decoy was interacting with, was a prosecutor.
Oh, okay.
So this is somewhere in Texas, a small city in Texas, where their sting operation was, they were undertaking their sting operation, and they figured out that the guy they were trying to lure was himself a prosecutor.
Okay.
So the prosecutor eventually stopped interacting with the decoy, and the producers of the show decided to drive over to his house with their van and their cameras and everything, accompanied by actual law enforcement officers. So they drove over to this guy's house, and he killed himself. He committed suicide. That ended the run of that television show, and it also created an awareness among law enforcement officers and prosecutors that there's a risk involved with working with these kinds of media companies when you're doing law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
It caused a lot of problems for that jurisdiction in Texas, and they ended up settling with the sister of the prosecutor who killed himself out of court, I believe. But the point isn't really so much that story, which did end the run of To Catch a Predator, by the way. But
okay.
The point of that story is that the when state officials get kind of intertwined with these programs, that they have in some cases realized this is a bad idea and kind of gotten out of it.
Yeah, so that incident really that put an end to Catch a Predator as a program. Then it's it came to kind of a violent end itself.
It did. Yeah. We call it punitive burnout.
Uh huh.
Yeah, they took it too far. So if the rules of that show were that, okay, we're going to lure people through this complicated seduction over the internet and a telephone, and if they don't show up, well, what are we going to do? We're not going to go chase them down. But it was too good to be true that the guy that was coming was a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. So they broke their own rules. They violated the logic that mm-hmm. they had themselves constructed, mm-hmm. and it backfired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, it had written that crimesploitation reinforces neoliberalism to escape psychological pressure of being self-disciplined in a society with a poor and shrunken social safety net.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I think that part of the story of crimesploitation, a simple way to put it, is it's a free and safe way to at least vicariously experience breaking the iron cage of bureaucratic society. I mean, that's just a really simple way to put it. But if everybody's wandering around America feeling frustrated and angst-ridden over their boring lives,
mm-hmm.
you can get, not, I wouldn't say voyeuristically, I would say vicariously enjoy a ride on the dark side as a way to stimulate part of your consciousness and your emotions. It's really how it appeals to your kind of thrill emotions,
mm-hmm.
safely. And I think that kind of crime tourism part of the story is subtle, because it isn't. That's not really what they're selling mm-hmm. when you see an advertisement for these shows. I mean, the you can think about it this way: is all of these shows start off with a warning, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
graphic content to follow or something. Well, I can't even remember what the warning is anymore, but
mm-hmm.
that's actually the opposite. They mean the opposite of that. They mean it's going to be great stuff about to, don't turn that dial. It's going to be great. Stay tuned. And so the point of saying that it enables people to kind of feel a sense of freedom is just a little taste, a kind of a hint of watching people break the rules
mm-hmm.
and getting a vicarious thrill.
Mm-hmm. Are there any benefits you see to some of the crimesploitation television programs or documentaries you highlight in your article? Could the public get some kind of useful information from this kind of entertainment, or is it all pretty much negative?
I think they can get some benefit from it. I'll use Making a Murderer as an example, because although in our paper about it we critique it for sure, based on the idea that at the end of the day it's still kind of celebrating retribution.
Mm-hmm.
But if people don't know much about the phenomenon of mm-hmm. wrongful conviction, and they don't know through an interesting case study of how prosecutors and law enforcement officers engage unethical practices or very unethical practices, mm-hmm. then it certainly is good for those reasons. And there's a long legacy of very good wrongful conviction documentaries and other mm-hmm. kinds of media around, you know, flaws in the justice system. And mm-hmm. so when you're, I think that what you have to try to do as a consumer of these shows or podcasts or whatever it may be, is do your best to be a kind of a critical consumer. So mm-hmm. the risk of in the kind of long game of valuing wrongful conviction stories or sort of looking at those as this beacon of hope to reform the justice system mm-hmm. is that if you reform the system in a whole bunch of smallish ways that help reduce wrongful convictions, you're kind of reifying the bigger picture of the justice system. You're not really critiquing it in a deep way. So look at it this way. So yes, it's good. We don't want people wrongfully convicted. I worked, my first area of interest in graduate school was wrongful conviction, and I wrote a paper about police misconduct in the LAPD in the late 90s.
Okay.
And I'm well versed in the literature on wrongful conviction, and I support it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've always thought about it is that all these documentaries, and there have been hundreds of them, and books and papers and movies about the innocent man, the problem with it in the long game or the big narrative is that when there's the prosecutors can say, oh, look, we got it right. We found out this guy was innocent and we let him go. And then that de-emphasizes all the people who have been, quote, rightfully convicted.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a couple of million people in prison in America, and if 100,000 or 200,000 of them are innocent, let's get them all out of prison. But what about the remaining 1.8 million
mm-hmm.
who some of them certainly should be incapacitated for some time, but there's lots and lots of them who might have been technically guilty of something, but mm-hmm. probably should not be doing long prison sentences.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very long-winded answer to your question,
okay.
But what I was trying to say here is that there are, of course, excellent forms of media about crime and punishment that can be educational.
Mm-hmm.
What we hope, if somebody's going to read our papers or our book, would be to try to be kind of a critical consumer of it and hopefully have some reflexivity while you're consuming it.
Mm-hmm. I read a book on with that the Innocence Project. I think it was attorney Barry Scheck and some other authors, and it was, I don't know if anyone's made a documentary of that, but that was really a fascinating review, and they had a lot of facts and statistics and all that they went through and how DNA technology is developed into such a way that they can really zero in on some of these cases that the people were claiming they were innocent, and they could look at it, and it had a lot of educational value, but that's not what I see on some of these shows about, you know, an innocent man was convicted.
Yeah, right. So Barry Scheck and a number of other attorneys and some scholars are the people that really created what some people call the Innocence Revolution or the Innocence Movement in mm-hmm. American law. And all of those cases are just like unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Read about, you hear about them, you learn about them. They're just incredible, and they continue to be revealed. I mean, people are being exonerated regularly,
mm-hmm.
and hundreds of people have walked out of prison for that were doing life sentences, and many for a number of people who were facing execution
yeah.
were innocent. So yes, it's an incredible story, and it's very, very important. And I don't want to minimize it at all. What I would say, and this would be an argument that, you know, Barry Scheck might disagree with me on, but mm-hmm. What I would argue is that the what has happened in this conversation in legal studies is that some have suggested that innocence should be the driving concept in
mm-hmm.
law and, or defense.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a counter argument that has said no, it's the opposite, in fact, that rights, people's rights, their due process protections should be the driving
mm-hmm.
emphasis. Because if you're only focusing on innocence, then there's going to be a lot of people who are technically guilty somehow, some way, that are going to end up de- publicized and not nobody, their people aren't going to take their cases as seriously. Mm-hmm. You'll have fewer defense people going into defense for the purposes of defending guilty people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a fairly esoteric conversation. I think for the public that's interested in crime and punishment, you know, just knowing about wrongful conviction is very important. And I think that, you know, the work of the Innocence Project and Barry Scheck and his colleagues is, like, really important.
Mm-hmm. I guess I get the impression when I hear about these different cases where people were innocent, the public would see that and get the impression, well, we really should not have this total trust in just because there's a system and someone's been convicted and they've been through the process, that therefore that's the end of it, that they would start to look at it with a little more critical eye.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's what has happened, and mm-hmm. I think, well, you know, I'm a little cynical about it just because it seems to me that almost every time there's one of these innocence cases, the reaction is of disbelief. Like, how could this happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember when I first watched Making a Murderer before LaChance and I were going to write about it, I was just sitting there thinking to myself, yeah, this has happened. We've heard this story many times. It's not new at all. And the reason we ended up writing about that paper, that documentary, is because I had a conversation with some people at a dinner party, and these were a couple, and they are they're the sister and brother-in-law of a good friend of mine, and they're a kind of a cool, hip couple living in Los Angeles. They work in media.
Mm-hmm.
They're sophisticated adults. And they were just, they couldn't believe the story of Making a Murderer. They just were, like, shocked that mm-hmm. this could happen, that this guy did 18 years in prison and he was innocent. They just were blown away. And I was having this conversation with them, and I was surprised at how surprised they were.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I'm in the ecosystem of this, so I'm very aware of it all.
Mm-hmm.
But these are sophisticated Angelenos who, one of them is an advertising agency. They're not out of touch with media. So mm-hmm. I was just a little surprised that these seemingly sophisticated, well-read adults in America didn't know that this kind of stuff was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right, it is educational, and maybe we just need to keep hearing it. But what I find, what causes cynicism sometimes in me is that people are shocked that the cops would plant evidence on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That's been happening for quite a long time.
Well, it's
not new.
It's not a new story, because it sounds very similar. The years ago, they had the documentary, The Thin Blue Line. I don't know if you've ever seen that. And it was it was another shocking story. And I believe it led to a guy's release, that documentary did. And I remember it being on the news and all that. So it's not a new story at all.
No, it isn't. And, you know, there are now, like, all kinds of academics who've been involved with it for a very long time, 20, 30 years. It's a field of study. I've myself taught classes on wrongful conviction. It's a very well-known phenomenon, and it nevertheless butts up against the much, much bigger narrative of law enforcement and Blue Lives Matter and the power of the prosecutor and this bigger story that is, you know, I don't want to use an academic word, but I would say it's hegemonic in American society. It's very hard to deconstruct or interrogate that big story of the police, you know, the institution of the police as a force of good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are always understood as bad apple counterfactuals that never, you know, even in cases where there's outrageous misconduct in police departments, the local institutions tend to think of it as a couple of bad guys doing bad stuff, as opposed to any kind of systemic mm-hmm. or institutional problems that enable that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of research on that question, but in the popular consciousness, it's challenging to undermine or kind of kind of interrogate the big story of the police and the force of good.
What's like, other than what we've already covered, what would you think, what would you want the public to get out of your work on crime, you and Dr. LaChance's work on crime exploitation?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I enjoyed the interview very much, too. I think that the idea here is, let's be critical consumers, okay? I think people do that already. You know, they're without having to be told by some academics. But what I'm hoping people can get out of it is to see the unspoken, covert, and maybe insidious aspects of television shows about crime punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And that when they, next time, you sit down and you're going to watch Gangland or Drugs Incorporated or the new one is Live PD.
Okay.
Ask yourself, who's benefiting from this? What kinds of stories are being told here that are maybe not obvious? Why do I like it?
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the thing that I would ask people. Uh-huh. Most, why do you like it?
Uh-huh.
And I ask my students that regularly, and it sort of sometimes causes them to pause and wonder for a minute. And if the answer is, oh, I just find it interesting, well, that's not a real answer, right? So, like, why do you find it interesting? So that may be the biggest question. Mm-hmm. Why do you like it? You know, if you watch Live PD, why are you watching it?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that question can help people think about the various levels of meaning that are being produced by these kinds of programs.
Well, I interviewed a true crime writer in the local area, Tobin Book, and I asked him why it gave people this interest in true crime, because it's been such a popular thing for so long. And then he said, well, I think it's what he called the gaper's block of like, if there's a car accident a little ways up, and you'll have a block of cars because everyone's slowing down to see the results of the accident, which of course means that it's just something violent or something like that. Is that basically means it's reinforcing to the people. But yeah, as to why that is so reinforcing, I don't have an answer to that. But
yeah, I think part of it is that one of the reasons people find it interesting, and I hesitate to sort of give answers, but one of the things that I think people find compelling is that there are consequences. There are like real life consequences. You're watching lock up, and a guy is stuffed in a cell. You know, that's you're you think you're observing real consequences for a human being that are transcendental to the kind of thing that you're experiencing walking around the world. Mm-hmm. If you see somebody dead in a car accident, those are real life consequences that you're confronted with. And by the way, death is a taboo, and it used to be in human history that death wasn't so much of a taboo until modernity and civilization, but human death was a part of life throughout human societies for most of the lives of Homo sapiens, and it's only been with the advent of civilization, modernity, that it's become a taboo.
Mm-hmm.
So when we see it, we experience it, we think about it, it's getting to understand, to have discourse about a taboo topic, and I think that can help us think about why people gape at car accidents, why they watch atrocities, why people watch beheading, ISIS beheading depictions and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a taboo.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. That's well put. Well, Dr. Kaplan, I really appreciate you being on. We've been about an hour now. I appreciate you coming on the podcast. What are you working on? You mentioned a little bit your upcoming work that you're doing on this topic. Is what would it be? What's the next step?
Well, we have the book. We're going to finish this book called Crime Exploitation, and that's going to involve a bit more writing and a lot of editing and making a manuscript into a book for publication. As I said, Stanford University Press, we're really excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a paper I'm working on that happens to be about, it's a kind of a comparison of American executions and executions by Islamic jihadi forces that I'm working on. And those are really the two main things that I have going on now. And Danny LaChance, Dr. LaChance, he's got our book, but he's got a couple of other irons in the fire that he could answer better than I can, so I'm not sure. But basically, finishing this book up, so for your listeners, keep your eyes peeled. The book will be out in about a year.
Okay. We'll keep an eye out for it. Thank you, Dr.
Great.
Kaplan.
Thanks a lot.
Criminal Behaviorology. Check us out on automatic.com or anchor.fm for this podcast, as well as our Facebook page and other social media sites.